6. If you don't, there are Bibles on the bookshelf, just because it's going to, we're going to go through quite a few verses. I'm going to count it through. But if people want to follow, please do so. We're looking at the book of Judges. Does that mean you grew up in church and did Sunday school and youth group and all of that? You know that it is the 6th book in the Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Joshua, Judges. We're looking at chapter 6. And today we are going to be focusing on Gideon. But I'm going to try and give a little bit of a background to the chapters that came before chapter 6. So in the book of Joshua, obviously Joshua led Israel to settle in the promised land after 40 years of walking in exile around the wilderness. And the book of Joshua actually focuses on the Lord just reminding Israel of how important it is to obey Him and obey His covenants. So we get into Judges. And in Judges, Israel continues to conquer Canaan after the death of Joshua. But they have not managed to completely drive the Canaanites out as God had commanded. And so therefore, those Canaanites that remained turned Israel towards the worship of idols. Now, as I mentioned, in Joshua, there was quite insistence from God on them not breaking the covenants and being obedient to Him. So this is obviously them doing exactly what they were asked not to do. So we see God stepping back and letting Israel learn from their mistakes and leaving them with no sort of divine leader. And each time, over and over, in the first 5 chapters, God sends a judge, and he or she would lead Israel to battle against their enemies, and they will win, and they will restore peace and prosperity, and then Israel turns to idolatry again. And this happens a few times. And then we come to Deborah. Deborah was the only female judge, and she's a prophetess. And we know the story of Deborah and Barak, where they defeat the Canaanite king and his general, Sisera, with a little help from another young lady called Jael. It's actually one of my favorite stories, mainly because it's the women who are doing it over there. But Deborah and Barak were so happy that in verse 5, we have a whole chapter that is a song of victory to God. And verse 5 ends with the words, "Then the land had peace for 40 years. And then we enter into verse 6. Chapter 5 ends with the words, "Then the land held peace for 40 years. And then we go into chapter 6. And interestingly, chapter 6 opens with the sentence, "The Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites." Isn't that interesting? 40 years of peace broken because the Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord. And now they've got 7 years under the hands of the Midianites. And verses 2 to 5 gives quite a graphic description of what happens with the Midianites. And it says, "Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern people invaded the country. They camped on the land, growing the crops all the way to Gaza, and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep, nor cattle, nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarm of locusts. It was impossible to count them or their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it, and Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help." The word that stands out for me there is, they come in with their livestock and tents like swarms of locusts. That just shows you the intensity number of people and things that would come unto Israel, like swarms of locusts. When they say swarm of locusts, number one, they're too many to count. They're wreaking havoc and they're destroying everything in their sight. And that's what the Midianites did to the Israelites. For 7 long years, every single year. Now, as I was reading this, I thought, well, what have I done that long? 7 years. I mean, they know that all they had to do was cry out for help, which they eventually did. But then I got to thinking, actually, isn't that what we do? When we're faced with challenges, what we do first is try to protect ourselves. Just like the Israelites who ended up leaving their homes to live in caves and strongholds, etc. We do exactly the same. We look at our options, we review them, we see where we can make cuts or repairs, we call on our support network, we change our jobs, we go for higher salaries, we invest in insurance, all the things that mean that we are now protected in some way. We tend to explore every possible option before we genuinely cry out to God for help. And I put my hand up because I have used these very words very often. Okay, Lord, I've done everything I could do now, so over to you. And I'm sure that I'm not alone in that. Like the Israelites, we hold out thinking, we can do this. We can handle this on our own. But when we do cry out to God, like the Israelites did, help comes. And he sends a prophet to them in verses 8 to 10 just to remind them of everything that he had already done in the past. And I think that's really important because sometimes we need to remind ourselves of everything that the Lord has done in the past. And then to remind them yet again that they haven't listened. Now we come to verse 11, and where we meet Gideon, and where Gideon is where I want to focus on today, even as we continue through. And it's very interesting how Gideon is introduced here. Gideon is working, when we meet him in verse 11, he's threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. He's working in secret. He's hiding away from the Midianites so they can't see what he's doing. He's hoping to complete his task without them knowing what's going on and before they come swarming in. That tells us that Gideon had that experience. He had the experience and he knew what the Midianites were capable of. He's probably discouraged, frustrated, and he's obviously afraid. So imagine his surprise when in verse 12 the angel appears and says, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Here we see that God's not defining Gideon by his current situation. He's addressing him based on what he knew Gideon was and could achieve. Now in society, we do tend to get asked, "Tell me about yourself." And I was going to start this by asking people to tell each other about themselves, but I decided not to. But we always base and describe it based on our current circumstances. So I say, "Oh, hello. I'm Philippian. I've worshipped at Mercy Baptist Church since 2004, and I'm part of the fellowship here. I'm married to Wayne. We have 2 adult children who are sometimes here with us, and we have a daughter here, and my mom's here as well. I'm a director for a regulatory body, and I'm a trustee at Starfish." All the things that is now is on our current situation. But the Bible tells us that we are so much more than our current situation. If you're a born-again believer, John chapter 1 verses 12 tells us that you're God's child. John 15:15 tells us that you're his friend. His masterpiece in Ephesians chapter 2 verse 10. And you've been justified, Romans 5:1. And forever free from condemnation from God in Romans 8:1. You're adopted into his family in Ephesians 1:5, and your citizenship is in heaven. Philippians 3:20. You belong to God. 1 Corinthians 6:20, never to be separated from his love. Romans 8:35. God sees you for who you are, not the situation that is around you. And he sees our true identity. But we have to be willing to accept that identity. Verses 13 to 24 shows Gideon questioning this new identity, this identity of mighty warrior. He asks, but why have all this happened if the Lord is with us? In verse 13, where are all these wonders that our fathers have told us about? You get from that Gideon probably felt very abandoned. And he does what we all do. He bases his identity in how he feels. On a good day, if I'm feeling great, and you ask me. On a bad day, if I'm not feeling great, and you ask me, the answers may well be different. But in verse 14, the Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of the Midianites' hand. Am I not sending you? And in verse 15, Gideon responds, well, pardon me, Lord, but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family. So Gideon is under no illusions. He knows that he's not the best, and he knows how unimpressive his resume is. He's the weakest in his clan, the youngest in his family. He doesn't have any authority, basically. He was focusing on his limiting factors. And again, something we do really well. It's interesting because Barry obviously spoke last week, and he was saying, why most people enjoy the heat? He doesn't. And he gave a little bit where he said, you know, I want to be open to the Lord and what he wants me to do, but I would really struggle if he sends me to a hot place. We focus on our limiting factors, don't we? Okay, Lord, I hear you saying X, Y, and Z, but I am not, and I am not, and I am not. Why don't you send Hailey? She is. No, this isn't an unusual scenario in the Bible. We see other examples of God using people who consider themselves flawed and who spoke about their limiting factors. Moses, the great leader of Israel, was deeply aware of his shortcomings. In Exodus chapter 4, verse 10, when the Lord called him to go to Pharaoh, what did Moses say? I am not adequate. Please send someone else. But God replied in verses 12 to 15, go anyway, Moses, because I will be with you. Which is the same thing he says to Gideon here. I will be with you. Gideon is not only given a commission. He is told the outcome, and he is assured that he's in partnership with God. I will go with you. Now, in both the cases of Gideon and Moses and any other example in the Bible, it's that personal encounter and the promise of partnership with God that changes things. But here's the thing, that's the same promise we've got. The Great Commission in Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 to 20. In verse 20, Jesus says, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. So we have that exact promise as he commissions us to go. He is with us. That's huge. And I hope we understand exactly what that means. Because we can see so many examples in the Bible where God is with others and the things that they accomplish when God is with them and they put their trust in him. One of my favorite verses is 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 9. It says, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power when his strength and his power comes into play. That's when he is actually able to accomplish his purpose. When we are weak and when we depend on him for strength. When we stop resisting and complaining and we allow his strength to be made perfect in our weakness, then and only then do we have the opportunity to display what God can really do. I'm going to continue to go through on the story of Gideon, and I'm done now at verses 25 to 32. Now before Gideon could be used publicly, he must first clean up his own house. His family was breaking the first and second commandments. They had idols on their property, idols to Baal. So the first thing God says to him was to take his dad's special 7-year-old bull and tear down the idols. Then Gideon was to sacrifice that bull using the wood that he destroyed from the destroyed idol. Now God had great things for Gideon, and Gideon was going to be quite public. What he was going to do was going to be quite public. But what God wanted first was quite personal. Tear down the idols. Our challenge today is to be really honest with ourselves. What are those idols that we carry? Now, they may not be big things that we erect and walk up to and worship on a regular basis, but they are there. Our homes, our money, all the things that allow us to have control and peace of mind. Are we holding them before God? Do they stand in front of God when we are having a relationship with him? Because if so, we need to tear them down. But that's a really, really hard thing. Now one of the things that I sort of mulled over in my head while I was preparing for this, because I don't have to ask myself what mine are, I know what they are. Am I willing to tear them down? And in doing so, all it asks is that we then confess that they are and bring them to God. Tear them down, deal with it, and then and only then can we be in full obedience to God. The thing is, God knows what they are. And he knows our weaknesses. He knows exactly what our weaknesses are. But in order for the Spirit of God to envelop us, we've got to get rid of them. And we see that in verse 34, where once Gideon was obedient to God, verse 34 says, the Spirit of the Lord enveloped Gideon, and he blew the ram's horn, and the troops, the Abiezrites, rallied around him. Now remember, Gideon was this person who, when we met him, he was hiding out. He thought he was the least, he was part of the least, the least clan, and he was the youngest in his family. Yet here we are, he's filled with the Spirit, he blows his horn, he commands an army. That's a huge step of faith. And that blowing of the horn, guess what? 32,000 men showed up. 32,000 men showed up ready to fight. That's not a small number. All this for a man who is willing to acknowledge his weakness, get rid of his idols, spend time in God's presence, and have the Spirit work through him. He blew a horn. But what's interesting is in verses 36 to 37, even though the Spirit of God was empowering him, he was still struggling with doubts. And so he asked God to do something. He tested God. In verses 36 to 37, he says, if you will deliver Israel by my hand, as he said, I will put a fleece of wool here on the threshing floor. If dew is only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, I will know that you will deliver Israel by my strength, as he said. And the loving, tender God that we serve confirms with the fire. And then Gideon again tests, but the other way around. And he says, right, the fleece must be dry and the ground must be covered with dew. And again, God confirms to Gideon. What I take from that is that God didn't want someone who wasn't fully convinced. So he was taking the time to assure Gideon so that he had full commitment from Gideon moving forward. Mm-hmm. And every time Gideon had a doubt, he matched that with reassurance. Every time Gideon had a doubt, he matched that with assurance. So it's not that the Lord doesn't expect us to doubt. He knows that we will doubt. He knows our weaknesses. And each time we doubt, he will reassure us. And I think sometimes we're afraid to test God. We're afraid to say, okay, Lord, if this is where you want me to go, and if this is what you want me to do, this is what I need to see. But actually, right here, we see that it's fine. He will give us the signs that we require. And he will show us the very same patience that he showed to Gideon. He wants to allay our fears. He wants us to grow into the man or woman of God that he desires of us. And that means that he will spend the time to reassure us. Now, so as not to leave the story hanging, I'm flipping over into chapter 7, and actually that's where all the cool stuff happens. But I'm going to go through really quickly and somewhat briefly the outcome of this encounter for Gideon. Now, in Judges chapter 7, verse 2, the Lord says to Gideon, you have too many people for me to hand you over to the Midianites. Sorry, for me to hand the Midianites over to you. Or else Israel might brag that we did it in our own strength. We did it by ourselves. So you're going to have to get rid of some of your men. So now the testing, God starts to really test Gideon as far as I'm concerned. Because remember, this isn't a man who is bursting with confidence. So the first test in verse 3, he simply asks that anyone who is fearful could live. If you're here and you're afraid to go into battle, you can live. 22,000 men left. So no, Gideon only has 10,000. He had 22,000 men who were faithful and left. And still God said that 10,000 is too many. So in verse 4, he says to Gideon, take your men down to the water and let them drink. Weed out any men who stick their face down in the water to drink. What kind of test is that? If you're able to drink politely, then you can stay. But if you're one who puts your face down in the water, you leave. Now, I'm trying to imagine myself in Gideon's place, because I know that I was not going to be very happy with that. I would have been having some conversations me and God around that. But Gideon did what the Lord said. A further 9,700 men were out, and Gideon was left with only 300 men. 300. Now we don't want to go into chapter 8, but chapter 8 does tell us that the Midianite army numbered 135,000. 135,000 as opposed to 300. That's 450 Midianites for every one Israeli soldier. Jesus tell us in Luke chapter 18 and verse 27? What's impossible with men is possible with God. Now there's a test of faith for us. The thing that I took away from that, that I want to share with the church this morning, is that accomplishing God's purpose is not determined by a bottom line on a finance sheet. It's not determined by how much we earn. It's not determined by the size of our congregation. Or how well we create or implement our plans and strategies. All of that's good stuff. But that's not what we need in order to accomplish God's purposes. And I know we had a church meeting on Thursday, which I was not able to attend. And sometimes we can feel quite small. Quite small. But God can still use us. The truth is, what God is looking for is to glorify himself through us. But first, we have to be fully dependent on him. We have to believe that he is with us. And we have to be willing to charge the hill in the name of the Lord. He doesn't need a majority vote from us. Frankly, he doesn't really need us at all. But he does invite us to join him in doing his will. And when we do, we accomplish great things in just the way that we see others who have accomplished great things with their weaknesses, with their small numbers, but given over to God, they win battles. It's happened before many, many times. Actually, the way that the battle was won for Israel is that the 300 men went out with trumpets, torches, and jars to meet the Midianites. The Midianites were there in all of their locust-like numbers. And God sent confusion into the ranks of the enemy so that they began attacking each other. And when it was over, 120,000 Midianites were killed and the rest fled. And God had answered Israel's prayer. So in conclusion, what I'd just like to remind Muslim Baptist Church of, sometimes God uses our challenging times to get our attention. So we really do have to ask ourselves, is he getting our attention? Or are we so focused on the challenge and protecting ourselves that we don't notice that God's trying to get our attention? The second thing I wanted to say to you today is that God always sees more in us than we see in ourselves. He sees us in our fullness, not in our situation or our circumstance. And frankly, he's not impressed by our strength. Neither is he hampered by our weaknesses. He will use us just as we are, but we just have to be willing to trust him. The third thing is that God confirms his priorities with his presence. However, in order to hear what he has in place for us, we have to be spending time in his presence. We have to be spending time in conversation with him. So again, the question I ask, are we doing that? Are we spending time in God's presence so that we can get confirmation of what he requires of us and what his priorities are? Then I also want to ask, are there things in your life, in your home, that need to go so that God can move in power in your life? And as a church, are there things that we are holding on to that need to go so that God can build his stronghold here? I think I am on the fifth. The fifth thing is just a reminder that God is patient with our faith process. He meets us exactly where we are in our weakness. All he wants is for us to put our trust in him. And he will be patient with us And he will assure us every step of the journey that he's asking us to take. Our success as a church and our success as individuals is determined by God's power, not ours. So, the question for us this morning is, will we trust him today? Will we depend on his power with our life, our children, our finances, our decisions, our relationships? Are we able to trust God fully with these? And as a church, will we trust him collectively with our church, our witness, our building, our finance, our size? Are we able to trust God fully on this? A few weeks ago, Haley preached the two messages on fasting. And so my final one will be, how serious are we about spending time in God's presence? And what are we willing to give up so that we can fully hear what he's saying to us?